My name is John Caldor from Australia's National Centre in HIV Epidemiology and Clinical Research. It's great to see you all here in Sydney. And I'm one of the two co-chairs of this session on access to care in the context of HIV vaccine and other prevention trials. I'd like to hand over to my co-chair, Karen Kaplan, to introduce herself and to keep the session moving along.
Hi, everybody. My name is Karen Kaplan from the TIE AIDS Treatment Action Group, and I'd like to welcome you to this session. And now, if Professor Tarantola is around, I'd like to invite him to introduce this session. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for being here with us this afternoon. I would like first to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, I would also like to welcome you to this very interesting, challenging session organized jointly by the World Health Organization, UNAIDS, and the University of New South Wales. We have among us a rapporteur, Cathy Slack, who is somewhere in this room, who will be taking notes of the presentations and comments. We will have a short summary that will be displayed on the websites of the co-sponsoring organizations shortly after the conference. Thank you.
It's a lot quicker than I thought it was going to be, but so obviously Danielle has been a key person in putting the session together, and we'll come back later on in the session for a presentation of his own. Now, the way the session is going to work is that we have seven formal presentations of 10 minutes each, and we're going to be asking the speakers to make sure they don't go beyond the 9 minutes, so we'll give them a bit of a reminder at 9 minutes if they're heading in that direction. And then there'll be two time slots for questions. There'll be, after the first four speakers, we'll have a 15-minute slot for questions and comments from the audience, and then after the last three speakers, we'll have a similar slot for questions and discussion. So I'd like to just remind you that the theme of this conference is the issues in this session is on issues in of access to care in the context of HIV vaccine and other prevention trials, and the objective is really to present up-to-date information from a number of different perspectives, and certainly to invite your discussion, but to really have the opportunity to air a number of different viewpoints. In that context, we have a range of speakers from a range of different contexts who will be presenting on this topic. So the first speaker is a person who's known to a lot of us who've worked in the field of HIV for a number of years, Dr. Saladin Osmanov, who's been with World Health Organization in relation to a number of activities around HIV since the late 1980s, and is now coordinator of the WHO UNAIDS HIV Vaccine Initiative and head of the TB and Malaria Vaccines Team at the WHO Initiative for Vaccine Research. So I'd like to ask Dr. Osmanov to present to you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for introduction. I will try to very quickly go through my talk to give you an idea of what WHO and UNAIDS have been doing in the area of HIV vaccine development, and in particular development of policies and strategies in relation to HIV vaccine research and development and clinical trials. First of all, let me summarize the present state of the HIV vaccine field. Today we face that there is a very high-level political commitment and support for HIV vaccine development efforts internationally, which are witnessed by the numerous international meetings, and especially the G8 summits. The last three discussed the issues of HIV vaccines and expressed their support for global HIV vaccine enterprise. There are multiple national and international programs ongoing, supported in the United States and Europe and developing countries, which are conducting vaccine research and clinical trials Some big foundations are allocating large amount of funds, you know, in support of HIV vaccine trials, and there is a growing number of developing countries which participate in developing and evaluation of HIV vaccines. The science of HIV vaccines, you know, is very complex today, and still we don't know exact correlates of immune protection. Multiple vaccine candidates are being developed. We know the problem with the HIV variability. Also, we know that the populations is highly variable, not only by social, cultural background, but also genetically by routes of transmission, all of which may have an impact on HIV vaccine development. And that is why there is today an urgent need to prepare sites, you know, for HIV vaccine trials, in particular large-scale phase 3 trials, which are extremely complex and require a lot of preparation, and especially development of harmonized and common policies that would facilitate and create favorable environment in support of HIV vaccine trials. So WHO has been acknowledging this, and the work in the field of HIV vaccines has started a long time ago in 1989. It was started in the Global Program on AIDS, continued at UNAIDS, and in the year 2000, WHO and UNAIDS jointly established WHO-UNAIDS HIV Vaccine Initiative. This initiative is guided by the HIV Vaccine Advisory Committee, chaired by Professor David Cooper from Australia. And since October, we are also dealing in our team with other vaccines, TB and malaria, which are also major challenges for the global health. And there are a lot of common issues, in particular in relation to policy development, regulatory aspects, and ethics. Based on this analysis, our initiative has identified, you know, areas of priorities. Of course, being in WHO, we do not develop products, do not conduct clinical trials, but there is a large amount of work to be done in the area of advocacy, capacity strengthening, development norms and standards and policies, which is a typical WHO role. Just to give you a few highlights and examples that WHO and UNAIDS have been working in, you know, there's been a large amount of work in the area of ethics, and in the year 2000, the first UNAIDS guidance document was developed, which is now under revision, and Dr. Kate Hankins will present this. There have been, however, these guidelines, they needed update, and because there have been multiple questions which remained unanswered, and WHO and UNAIDS organized various regional consultations in Africa, Latin America, Asia, Eastern Europe, which reviewed these ethical principles and guidance documents with regard to HIV vaccine trials and access to care and treatment. And based on these discussions, you know, the position paper has been prepared, which is which you can have published in the journal Vaccines, and you can get a copy at the back of the room on the table there. And then, of course, this paper will be presented later on in this session by Dr. Daniel Tarantola. One of the issues that WHO UNAIDS has been also looking into, you know, the participation of women and adolescents in HIV vaccine trials, and this is obvious based on the epidemiology, and HIV, future HIV vaccines will be must be targeted for use in this population, and because this population will benefit the most from effective and affordable HIV vaccines. We organized the serious consultations, and again the report has been published and is in AIDS Journal and could be made available to you. There are a number of regulatory challenges and policies related to that. In particular, there are novel concepts of HIV vaccine trials which are not well understood by the communities, by the regulatory authorities. And WHO has been also supporting consultations and published guidance documents, the so-called phase 2B trial, which we'll hear later on at this conference. And also there is an urgent issue to define what is the what is expected HIV vaccine efficacy and outcomes of vaccination. To address that, we organize consensus meetings, consultations with all key stakeholders. The last part in my talk, I want to mention that that we are working a lot in strengthening national capacity in support of HIV vaccine trials, in particular in developing countries. And the approach we are taking is not that only focusing on trial-specific aspects like laboratory, epidemiology, or clinical trial, but also the other components of the environment which can make the trial successful or unsuccessful, including the community involvement, government support, public media attention, etc. To address that, we work with countries and help them developing the national HIV vaccine plans, which do develop policies and plans to strengthen capacity of countries to conduct clinical trials at the highest scientific and ethical standards. The latest generation of this plan also the look into possibilities of integrating the activities within that plan with other HIV prevention and treatment programs, but also other vaccine trials, not only HIV trials, but vaccine and prevention trials which may happen in the country. Important work WHO and UNAIDS is doing in the area of building up regional networks, and one of the examples is the African AIDS Vaccine Program, which represents scientific community in Africa and promotes the development of HIV vaccines in Africa. And there are various areas in which this program is very active, including advocacy, biomedical sciences, population studies, ethics, law and human rights, national strategic planning, and, of course, community involvement. So this type of regional programs, they do stimulate the HIV vaccine trials in Africa, and you can see an example that in the year 2000, when this program started, there was only one country in Africa which conducted one HIV vaccine trial. In 2006, there have been 8 countries, and of course, this is an effort of multiple partners, but through the African programs, it will make sure that the African countries do take active part and active partners in these trials and research in Africa. So what kind of challenges today we have for policy development and regional networking? We have unity of mission and shared vision today, which is a good sign. But however, there are challenges related to coordinate and promote regional networking. We need to optimize capacity building and site development. We need to develop unified clinical trial platforms on global and regional basis. Careful assessment, development, and harmonization is needed, addressing sensitive policies based on extensive consultation with all stakeholders, and we need actively involve the communities in this vaccine research. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Saladin. And I'd like to ask you to note your questions, because we're going to have all the first four speakers to receive questions after they've finished. So please make note of the questions, and you can refer them to the individual speakers after that. The next speaker in this session is Dr. Catherine Hankins, who also has a very long history working in HIV, first within the from a base at McGill University in Canada, and then more recently at UNAIDS in Geneva, and has the role of being the chief scientific advisor to UNAIDS, which is, I can imagine, is a very major undertaking in itself. So thanks very much.
A daunting task. I hope these slides have worked out. They seem to be changed in the format as we put them in. And I just want to say this is a very niche talk within this whole session, because the session is about care, basically, and I am going to talk to you about prevention, standard of prevention. I'm taking all of the comments I'm going to make from the new revision that we've done of the vaccine document that Saladin had mentioned that was from 2000. This is from 2007, and it's for all biomedical HIV prevention trials. In the room, we have several people from the expert panel who helped us, from Kate McQueen and Dersu Greco and Kathy Slack, and Vasantha couldn't be with us, but and there may be others of you. The idea is that we are accepting comments on this until the end of August, and I've left a few copies at the desk here, if they aren't any left by the time you get and you want one, just give Saladin your card and we'll send the PDF for you to have a look at. So the guidance on standard of prevention, it takes two formats. There are two documents. The document I'm talking about here is the ethical considerations document, but we've also produced one on good participatory practice. And in that, in the working group, Karen was on that working group. They are both aimed at guiding scientifically rigorous and strong, from an ethical point of view, conduct of ongoing, so trials that are already out in the field, and future biomedical HIV prevention trials. The good participatory practice guidelines were developed with AVAC, the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, and the ethical considerations with WHO. And I'm just going to be talking about standard of prevention. And this is guidance point 13 in the ethics document. And it basically has two major points. One is about appropriate counseling and access to all state-of-the-art HIV risk reduction methods. And the second is about what should happen if there are new methods that come along that are proven, that are validated and approved by relevant authorities. What should the decision-making be for trials that are in the field and for trials that are in the planning stage? So first of all, let's look at risk reduction. There's an ethical principle of beneficence that obligates researchers and sponsors to maximize the benefits and minimize the risks to participants in clinical trials. And acquiring HIV is one of those risks. There's a full, now we'll see, we might get into some trouble, but we'll give this a try with these slides. But there's a full range of information and services that are required for HIV risk reduction. Counseling access, entitlement to proven HIV prevention methods, and access to post-exposure prophylaxis in the event of a known likely exposure. It's not going forward. Is it stuck? Okay, thank you. The risk reduction counseling, when we talk about that, what standards are we talking about? First of all, we say that the technique, the frequency, and the message content of the counseling sessions have to be agreed upon by a partnership that is community, government, investigator, and sponsor based on reliable information about the prevailing social and behavioral characteristics of the study population. Now, it has to be carefully monitored to ensure that it's good quality in order to minimize potential conflicts of interest because there are obviously the interest of risk reduction and the interest of the scientific goals of the trial, which requires seroconversions to occur in order to be able to tell if there's going to be a difference between the intervention arm and the control arm. Consideration should be given, and we're not saying this has to happen, but consideration should be given to providing counseling through an agency or an organization that is independent of the investigators in order to prevent any real or perceived conflict of interest. However, if such an arrangement is put into place, then both the researchers and the community must ensure that the services are of high enough standard to meet the trial's ethical obligations, because if it's poor standard, the fact that it's outside the trial and then doesn't make any difference. It means it's still a conflict of interest. So in the instance where you decide to do that, it means developing local capacity to provide such services in a culturally suitable and sustainable fashion. And it means that there should be evaluation of the pros and cons of doing this, that there has to be rigorous evaluation if it is decided that to do this is warranted and it is found to be feasible. I think this slide is going to be a problem, too. Okay, thanks. One of the things that happens, though, when you're following through on international guidance on ethics, you encounter legal constraints on public health practice. For example, if we're advocating, and I think there were parts missing on a previous slide, if we're advocating access to reproductive health care services, contraception, what about therapeutic abortion in situations where that is not legal? What about the provision of appropriate risk reduction interventions for trial participants who inject drugs, including for sterile injecting equipment and drug substitution treatments such as methadone and buprenorphine? I think we've got, see, I think, can you move it up or can you make it smaller? You can't do anything. Okay. What we're suggesting is that you explore with local authorities what are those constraints and what are the ways to overcome them. I'm sorry about this. What about novel HIV prevention strategies? What do you do about them? We're basically arguing here that you need to set up mechanisms for negotiation before the trial even starts. And I'm talking here about situations where a trial will start and it's in the field and a new method is confirmed as being effective. What do you do? Well, the first place is set up those kinds of negotiations so you can talk when these happen about whether you should be introducing them or not, and there are pros and cons of introducing them. Those negotiations are going to have to take into account the feasibility of doing it, the expected impact, and whether you'll still be able to measure the impact of the biomedical HIV prevention modality that you're testing. So, for example, if there is a decision that a new modality should be introduced, but that means that the sample size has to be tripled and the trial has to be shut down because it's no longer feasible, that has to be a joint decision of all the stakeholders, all the research stakeholders, not just of the sponsor, not just of the community, not just of the researchers. And I'm just going to close. I apologize for us having missed a few of the points I wanted to make, but I just wanted to close to tell you a little bit about these two documents. The first is the Good Participatory Practice Guidelines, and basically it takes you through the life cycle of a clinical trial, a prevention trial, using these core principles to identify what are the relationships and the underpinnings for those relationships between communities and researchers and sponsors. And the second one is this one, Ethical Considerations in Biomedical HIV Prevention Trials, and there are 19 guidance points, and we've tried to sequence them in the order in which you might want to consider them if you were preparing a research protocol or beginning to work on some of these ethical issues. And as you can see, they do include community participation and capacity building, and they go right through to availability of outcomes, what is to happen if a product is proven to be safe and effective, how is it going to be scaled up for the community in which the research occurred, for the country, and for other populations. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Kate, and thank you for catching up a couple of minutes for us as well. Again, please save your questions after the first four speakers. We'll have an open opportunity. The next speaker in this session is Kate McQueen. Kate also has an incredible depth of experience in prevention research with a particular focus on the social science and ethical side as the senior scientist in social science for Family Health International over the last 5 or 6 years and prior to that with the CDC. Thank you.
Thanks. I also want to thank the sponsors for the opportunity to present this talk today on some of the lessons that we learned from the conduct of our TDF trial a couple of years ago, and in particular our experience in the Cameroon trial with regard to ensuring access to care. So in 2006, Family Health International completed the first clinical trial to determine whether tenofovir, a drug widely used to treat HIV infection, can also prevent HIV infection. And although there were too few infections during the trial to indicate whether tenofovir is protective, short-term use of the drug was shown to be both safe and acceptable for HIV-negative West African women who are at risk of being infected. All participants received HIV risk reduction counseling, condoms, and treatment of sexually transmitted infections as medically indicated during monthly clinic visits. And the results of the study were presented at the 16th International AIDS Conference in Toronto last year and subsequently published in Public Library of Science or PLOS Clinical Trials online. The study tested a daily oral form of tenofovir among 936 women in Ghana, Cameroon, and Nigeria. Half of the women were randomized to receive daily tenofovir and half to receive a daily placebo. The women were then followed for up to a year. In Cameroon, the study closed early due to a number of emergent controversies, including concerns about whether women who became infected with HIV during the trial would have appropriate access to HIV treatment and care. And in this talk, I'm going to briefly review how this issue unfolded during the Cameroon trial, the lessons that we at FHI learned, and the actions that we're taking to address the issue of ensuring access to care in our HIV prevention research more broadly. So, and very quickly, what I want to cover today is a little bit about the trial in Cameroon, a formative research that we undertook, the referral process we originally developed, the emergent problems, the resolutions that were reached with as we confronted those problems, and then further action that we've been taking since then. So, as previously noted, the clinical trial was conducted in three African countries, and of the 936 women enrolled, 400 were from Douala, Cameroon, and the trial in Cameroon was therefore fully enrolled before we closed down. At all three sites, the research included a formative socio-behavioral component as well as a clinical component. The formative research began well in advance of the trial at each site, and in Cameroon actually commenced a full year before the trial began. The formative research included multiple components, including an assessment of the care and treatment options that existed within the community. These data were used to develop site-specific recommendations for linking HIV-infected participants to healthcare resources. In Douala, 8 people living with HIV/AIDS and 7 providers were interviewed, and visits were made to a range of facilities. Findings were summarized in an extensive report that included a comprehensive listing of resources. The report also described both PLWHA and provider experience with and knowledge about the resources available. The report was shared with the clinical research team in Douala and also at FHI in North Carolina. We identified a range of options for care and treatment. These were identified by the formative research team in Douala, Cameroon, along with potential barriers and options for facilitating access. In Douala, it was decided that HIV-positive women, whether discovered at screening or during the study, would be referred to a community clinic where one of the trial physicians was the chief medical officer. The clinic had a program for following HIV-positive people that included medical and psychological support. The cost to clients at the clinic was about $9 US to enter the program, which paid for CD4, complete blood count, AST and ALT tests, and access to services. If a client needed treatment, the cost was about $9 per month for antiretrovirals. The decision on when to start ART was based on CD4 counts. When trial enrollment first began, the clinic costs for the HIV care and treatment programs were not covered for the trial, by the trial, for either seropositive women screened out or the women who seroconverted during the trial. Also, the referral process was not formalized with the clinic. For example, there was not a memorandum of understanding that was drafted or any other formal document. Women who seroconverted had the option of remaining in the study but did not take the study pills. They could come for monthly follow-up visits, receive the same safety testing, including ALT and AST, the same monthly safer sex counseling, and the same free condoms as the seronegative participants. All of the women who became infected with HIV during the study were referred to a healthcare counselor hired specifically to facilitate referrals for any identified health needs, not just those related to HIV. The health counselor also offered to accompany each seropositive woman to her first visit to help her register for services. Across all three sites participating in the trial, 8 women on study drug or placebo became infected with HIV. Of the 2 women in the tenofovir group who became infected, 1 was from Ghana and 1 from Cameroon. Of the 6 in the placebo group, 2 were from Ghana, 1 was from Nigeria, and 3 were from Cameroon. Early in the implementation of the trial, concerns were raised by ACT UP Paris and by advocates within Cameroon about a number of issues. A key concern centered on the ability of seroconverters to access HIV care and treatment, including antiretrovirals when needed. With support from our funder, we began efforts to make funds available to cover program enrollment costs for HIV care and treatment of seroconverters. These efforts included changes to subagreements and also to the consent forms, which needed to now include mention of such funds in the discussion of trial benefits. Simultaneously, the access to care issue was picked up by the popular press in Cameroon, and the situation quickly escalated. In February 2005, the Ministry of Public Health suspended provision of the study product to participants to allow review of study procedures in the wake of media controversy. The review resulted in a number of recommended steps, all of which were addressed. However, permission to restart provision of study product was not given, and FHI eventually officially closed the trial in Cameroon in September 2005. Monthly follow-up of women already enrolled in the trial continued until that time, including clinical safety tests, HIV testing and counseling, and provision of condoms. In Cameroon, an additional 6 women became infected after study drug was withdrawn and before the study closed down in September 2005. Thus, a total of 10 women became infected while enrolled in the study in Cameroon. Ultimately, resolution of the controversy grew out of a broad-based stakeholder meetings that were sponsored by the IAS with support from Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. In Cameroon, FHI signed a contract with a local hospital to provide 15 years of care and treatment to the 10 women who became infected there, to include up to 5 years of antiretroviral treatment support when needed. A non-governmental organization has also agreed to provide additional psychosocial support for the women. FHI has asked that the study staff and hospital administrators provide regular updates on which participants are accessing services and what services are being provided. Similar arrangements were made in Ghana for the 3 serial converters there. And in addition, the 1 woman from Nigeria who became infected was enrolled in the PEPFAR program in Ibadan. At FHI, we've taken additional steps to address the access to care issue in our HIV prevention research. In 2005, we undertook a self-assessment of all of our sponsored HIV prevention trials, which included both PrEP and microbicide research. This assessment looked at what each trial and each site was doing to facilitate access to HIV care and treatment, pregnancy care and family planning counseling, and STI care and treatment. All studies but one covered at least some cost for seroconverters. However, the length of time that each study covered the cost varied, and most of the studies lacked details about how needs were being met. Types of costs associated with care and treatment that were covered included program enrollment fees, CD4 and viral load tests, transportation, and monthly program fees. Overall, investigators were making a concerted effort to arrange HIV care and treatment, but there was considerable variation in the way that needs were handled within and between countries and also between studies. Everyone indicated that they were looking for guidance and a consistent policy. Based on this assessment, our experience with the TDF trial, and other work, a key recommendation has emerged. Procedures need to be formalized and standardized. Formal agreements need to be developed with referral sites. Designated funding needs to be identified to support the referrals. Staff need to be hired to support referrals. And documentation is needed to ensure that the procedures put in place, in fact, lead to the intended outcomes. We are now in the final stages of developing a formal policy in line with these recommendations. We're also giving greater consideration to the need for extended follow-up of seroconverters as part of trial design in order to evaluate outcomes such as effects on viral set point, disease prognosis, and viral resistance. Such follow-up would also facilitate ongoing support for and access to HIV care and treatment. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kate. And the final speaker in this first group of papers is Cheryl Overs, originally from Australia, and was a key person in developing programs that assessed supported the rights and other issues for male, female, and transgender sex workers, both in this country and then after that in the international arena. So Cheryl's been a key person for 20 years in that domain. So.
Yeah, since I was 15. Okay. Thank you very much indeed, John, for that introduction, and thank you for the invitation to speak to Daniel and others. It's this is an exciting conference for me to be at and for the Asia Pacific Network of Sex Workers to be represented at. Usually community and science are given separate spaces, as it were. And so that's one of bridging the gap, in this case bridging the chasm, is something that I thought that I'd talk a little bit about in relation to sex workers and research, and specifically vaccine research. I also will be drawing on the tenofovir experience from Cambodia. I was involved to some extent, and I was there last week, and we put this presentation together with the sex workers who were involved in the tenofovir trials in Cambodia. I don't know if you can read that sign on the little Barbie dolls. We use these little dolls for sex workers to write their messages to the world, and that says, we need drug trial, but drug trial must too have ethical property. Oh, it says that down the bottom. Sorry. And so that's the first thing I'd like to stress, is that sex workers are extremely committed to drug trials and certainly to vaccine trials. So a lot of the troublemaking and rabble-rousing that stop trials shouldn't be misunderstood as not supporting the outcome. And so I think that needs to be made very clear at the start. Few quick points that others will cover. The question of, I can't say it properly, beneficence, is that how you say it? The question of who's going to benefit. And of course we're very, who benefits in trials, but we're also very concerned about long-term benefits. And so with the new prevention technologies coming on board with HIV vaccines, the first question for sex workers is, are we going to benefit from those? And a 60% effective microbicide or a 70% effective vaccine is certainly a concern. Benefit in trials is for trial participants is, of course, also a huge issue. I'm going to go back to that in a moment. Seroconversions being anticipated and needing to happen is a difficult and complex message that sex workers in poor countries find difficult to take on board. But specifically here, I wanted to speak first about the idea of existing prevention services remaining in place. And I just would like to make the point that monthly safer sex counselling is what? Being told once a month to have safe sex. So monthly safer sex counselling, condoms and STI treatment is not an effective HIV prevention package for sex workers. Behaviour change services are dose related. Not only do we need all of the services, we need the full package, and we need an adequate dose of those services. So that's not being delivered in almost any context, and certainly not in trial context. And then there's the question of compensation for injuries, and the main injury we hear being discussed is HIV seroconversion. And last week I spent hours with sex workers trying to get them back to the issue of HIV conversion. And it was an interesting gap, because they were much less concerned about HIV, about contracting HIV. In fact, they were not very concerned about that at all. They said, well, we use condoms. We're not very much at risk of HIV. So that showed a huge gap. They're concerned about other injuries. And that showed a huge gap between the perception of the researchers, where they're being researched because they're high-risk women who are expected to have seroconversions, and their own perception of themselves, which is that they're not at high risk of HIV. And then the final one is informed consent and issues around language and various issues that came up around informed consent. But I'm not going to focus on all of those. What I want is to lower the tone a little bit and talk about how sex workers see it, how sex workers see well-intentioned and ethical researchers like our chairperson, and their perception and how we hear them. And the most important thing that sex workers have to say to researchers, to science, to the general community, to their governments, and above all at the moment to UNAIDS, is that we were told we can contribute to saving humanity, but why should we? What has humanity done for us? Sold us, discriminated against us, raped us, kept us powerless, and now we're being asked to contribute. So that's an overall message that we hear over and over again, and researchers, quite understandably, tend to say, well, that's fine, but I haven't sold you, discriminated against you, raped you, or kept you powerless. What I'd like to do is an ethical trial. That's a very difficult... Oh, difficult conversation. That conversation happens at a level that doesn't necessarily match. So what do we do about that? Capacity building for sex workers is clearly an extremely important important aspect of getting informed and ethical participation in trials, and that's the part that I've participated in more than negotiating with researchers. And there's so much to learn. When you're in the position of not being literate in your own language, having no education, of being raped, and as we know, and I'm talking about Cambodia, where 94% of sex workers, of female sex workers in Phnom Penh, were raped in the previous year from the end of 2006. So we're talking about women who are subject to violence and to abuse continually. So we need to understand that they're the women who are trying to take on these issues. So the first thing, of course, that we need to talk to build capacity about is understanding of the body, the clinic. What is it? What's a vaccine? What's prophylaxis? What are all the medical issues? Why are drugs trialed? The difference between a safety trial and a phase 3 trial. And we have mixed success with this. I recently took some medications to Cambodia that they asked me to take, and I started delivering a lecture on not taking more and got a very sort of, Cheryl, we understand dose response. And I was like, oh, great. Yeah, I was really happy. That shows that the capacity building's working. And then 10 minutes later, they were saying something about how drugs are tested on monkeys in rich countries but on them in poor countries. So they'd had got dose response, but they hadn't got the difference between phase 1 and phase 3, between safety trials and other trials. So that's a huge job to be doing, and that takes an enormous amount of time. We do that with body mapping. We do that with participatory methods. The other one is understanding the institution and the policies and the politics around drug trials in general. And when I saw this poster produced, I don't know again if you can see that, it says WHO, UNFPA, World Bank, there's various institutions there, and I personally feel that that's very impressive, that this capacity building has extended to these women understanding. Because often when people come, they're just the white people, the foreigners with money. And it's very, very difficult to have a context of understanding the difference between somebody from Big Pharma, somebody from UNAIDS, somebody from an NGO, somebody, you know, or a journalist. When you're a sex worker in a project in Phnom Penh, strange white people are coming with all sorts of ideas, all sorts of, you know, continually. And so to work out who they are is quite a challenge. And then the last one, of course, is the complex issue of explaining to people that microbicides are not a substitute. Then we have the problem of how to provide that technical support. And in fact, we had people saying that it was all done by external manipulators, which is not true. And the third one, listening for researchers, I've made the point that people were worried about what if their arms drops off or what if my kid has two heads. Now, you can hear that as an ignorant comment, but this is Cambodia, where people do see armlessness every day, thanks to Agent Orange, which they were assured wasn't dangerous. The condom use, the idea that we need seroconversions, but so you should still use condoms, is problematic. And the third one is the promise of HIV care seems to be a right anyway, whether or not you contract HIV in a trial, so that didn't make sense to anybody. And finally, people turn up and talk with to talk to sex workers, not understanding that they're in a context anyway. In the case of Cambodia, here's an example of how HIV prevention is done by the Cambodian government. And so when that's going on, you can hardly expect people to trust people associated with these forms of HIV prevention campaigns, or to differentiate. So when that's a question of quality listening. When we hear those comments, which at first can sound ignorant and confused and are an obstruction to participation, that can all be understood and listened to differently, and many of those obstacles can be overcome with serious and well-resourced capacity building. And I hope we see more of that. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cheryl. I'd like to invite the audience to come to the microphones and introduce themselves and ask a question of any of our first four speakers, or make a comment in relation to the presentations. Please give your name and then make a brief comment or question.
Well, hello, my name is Peter Newman from the University of Toronto. This could be for any of the first speakers. And I really did enjoy the talks, and they're very helpful to me as a social scientist kind of doing research on this whole thing to know where important world bodies are at. One of the concerns that I'm hearing in a small study I'm doing among people who have screened into a phase 2B trial in Toronto but have declined to enroll, which is, of course, their right, and we've discussed with them issues, some of the issues appear to be much more kind of around emotional anxiety and psychological dimensions than I've seen in some of the research about hypothetical willingness to participate. What I'm wondering is if there's consideration beyond counseling about HIV prevention specifically. These folks don't expect, you know, ongoing psychological counseling, but nonetheless, they're very concerned about false positives, that it's not just cognitively they know that it means they're not infected, but they're still extraordinarily anxious about that. And two, they wonder, how do they talk to potential partners or their current partners about being in a trial, or about, well, you know, I'm positive, but I'm not really positive. So some of these issues that go beyond strictly risk reduction or maintaining lower risk behaviors.
Okay, so your first question is about anxiety that participants might have about the trial issues, and the second is about the context of their partners and other relationships?
If there's discussion counseling beyond strictly behavioral...
Okay, so thanks. Any of the first four speakers want to address those points?
I kind of understood the question a little differently than John, maybe, because I thought you were asking about, you're giving the example of anxiety and these kinds of concerns and what you need to do as a researcher to be able to respond to those. And I think what we've tried to do is to look at the whole continuum and say, you have people who screen out, you have people who actually screen in but don't want to participate, change their mind because of anxiety, and you have people who stay in the trial, and all of those people have needs, and that, therefore it's so important to create the referral mechanisms and the links to local public services and to monitor the quality of the kinds of services that are being offered. So that would be my response. Those are valid concerns that people have, and you know, developing those links can help to make sure that they get addressed appropriately.
Also about the counseling, you know, before enrollment in the trial, you know, in many countries now there is a lot of experience gaining that, and it has been shown that it's not one point in time procedure, you know, it's a whole process of education about the trial, potential risk, potential harms, social and related to vaccine, not related to vaccine. And then only after this, there are certain stages when the volunteers and the potential volunteers are assessed about their understanding about the trials, they do provide informed consent. So that's a whole informed consent procedure does address this issue.
Just one other comment to add to that. I think a lot of trials are increasingly sensitive to the fact that people live in relationships and not just as independent individuals, and that counseling sometimes has to at least provide the opportunity for partners to come in or to discuss ways in which this communication can be fostered and built up and provide active support for it, rather than simply telling people that they need to go home and figure it out on their own. And this is true in microbicide trials as well as in vaccines.
Thanks. We might move on to the next question.
Good afternoon. My name is Cedrian Martin. I'm from the Trinidad Express newspaper. Ms. Hankins, you referred to the monitoring and ethical frameworks for ongoing and future research. And I was just wondering what mechanisms are there in place to address the concerns of participants in trials that have gone by. Let me read briefly. A participant in a trial in Trinidad said 19 volunteers who developed antibodies were seen and tested, but the others were called a year after and just asked if they wanted a free HIV test. That was it, no follow-up medicals. So what happens if the trial is gone and there are not these procedures in place?
I guess the best response to give to that is that those are the kinds of things that need to be decided before a trial starts. And there needs to be agreement in this, we're calling it a community, government, sponsor, researcher partnership, on what's going to happen during the trial, what's going to happen following the trial, both in terms of access to product if it's safe and effective, but also in terms of follow-up for any trial-related issues. So I can't speak to the particular example that you're giving, but I think that if it's agreed ahead of time and also agreed how emerging issues are going to be handled, things that no one anticipates at the start but that come along, how are they going to be discussed? What forum is there going to be to come to resolution on those? I think that starts to answer some of those questions.
So people in trials gone by have no recourse?
I don't know. I'd have to think about who the sponsor was and what was the agreement. I don't know. I mean, I'd have to talk with you about the particular instance to see. Theoretically, you know, they should have been linked in with local services to be able to be followed up.
I guess one other point to make on that would be to think about who were the people who had actually done the research and whether there are any ongoing relationships that you could go back to the people who had worked on it and see if they would be open to discussions about how to resolve this issue, and hopefully they would be.
I think what we found from our experience in Cambodia is that it's very difficult to, the long-term relationships can be there in theory and even on paper, but there's no experience with actually sustaining those things. So there's no track record, if you like, to say that these things can work. There's the institutional structures have not been around long enough or been tested to. So you can give a commitment, but it's very hard to know whether it's going to be valid or not. Another question at the back.
Linda Gale-Becker from the Desmond Tutu Centre, Cape Town. I guess my question mostly is to you, Kate, just and my concern is around the risk reduction counselling and other counselling for these prevention trials. And it's really, I guess, around the accreditation and the quality control of the kind of counselling that we're doing. Would you imagine that that is also something that's agreed upon in this partnership between community and sponsor and so on? Or are we going to see some standardized guidelines or even some method of making sure that counseling is really accredited and is quality controlled throughout the trials?
That's a very interesting idea. I'm not aware of any movement at this point in time to certify counselors and say this person has been through the training course and has the experience and the expertise to be able to do counseling to the standard required for an HIV prevention trial. But obviously it would be, I mean, that part of what was missing on my slide is the kind of evaluation and certification that would be required if you were farming it out, in a sense, if you're contracting out to other people and you need to be able to see that they met that standard. Within the trial itself, obviously there's real concern that those standards be met. And the importance of community engagement to be assessing and evaluating and keeping a very close eye on exactly that, is the risk reduction counseling of adequate quality. That's a critical issue. I'm not answering you well, but I think this is an area that needs more development.
Question in the front.
Jessel Greco from Brazil. I want to go back to concern about care and treatment. And I should start saying first that I should congratulate WHO and UNAIDS for these documents and trying to make points that people can follow in a way that's ethical for everybody. But there's one point on the care and treatment that you didn't have much time to show that says that everyone that gets in a biomedical trial and get infected should be provided access to treatment regimens from among those internationally recognized as optimal. But there's another phrase after that that says that any deviation from this standard must be justified. My point is that the same way as Family Health International decide by themselves to do things beforehand, not opening anything to people to decide not to get the best. My suggestion is that in this document, this phrase should be erased, and people should get the best anywhere they were. Because that's the only thing I want to add is that if you open a gate saying that the standard, if it's changed, must be justified, you can get double standard depending on where you are. That's just my big concern. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Luke?
Kate, I would like to ask some.
First, introduce yourself.
I gave my name, Lit Van Damme, from Better Child.
There's two Kates here.
Yeah.
We have two Kates.
Kate Hankins. You say that one of the recommendations is that the counseling should be done by people independent of the trial, which seems contradictory to a meeting I was in June by the Global Campaign of Microbicides, who the organization assessed everything with regard to care in a very broad sense in the ongoing only microbicide trials. And they came out with a recommendation that it's perfectly okay and maybe better that it's done by the trial people themselves, the group who is seeing the participants.
No, I'm sorry if that was misunderstood. Basically, what it says is consideration should be given to it, but we're not saying you should do this. In fact, as I think Kate McQueen might attest, because she has an actual experience with looking to see whether farming it out is a good idea or not, you obviously have less control or feel as a research team and as a community, you have less control over the kinds of quality of what's being offered if it's being done outside the context of the trial. So it is not a flat recommendation at all. I think it requires discussion amongst all the partners as to what's going to be the best to make sure that that conflict of interest, which is inherently there, as Cheryl says, you need to have seroconversions happening. You want to keep those to a minimum because you need to reduce risk wherever possible. But on the other hand, you need them to be happening, and so you've got a conflict of interest in terms of making sure the quality of risk reduction counseling and the tools that you provide are the best that you can possibly do.
I just wanted to reiterate the point I made that we shouldn't be too place too much emphasis on counselling, because counselling is one of at least 10 components that are required for a proper HIV package. I've already made this point, but I'd just like to reiterate it, because again we're seeing the idea that good counselling sets up HIV prevention to an acceptable ethical standard, and that's not the view of communities that are involved in trials.
Yeah.
Hi. I have a question for the
last speaker. Name, please.
Name is Peter Newman from the University of Toronto. I really enjoyed your talk. Really, for me, very important to hear. But really, given what you said, I wondered, is it really plausible that an HIV prevention trial, particularly a biomedical trial, can be conducted among sex workers in a setting where 95% are raped and a lot of the violence and structural issues come down from their own government and community? How can someone who's running a trial ensure any level of protection for these women to then say, we can moderate the level of risk that you may engage in the trial?
Well, I don't think you can. I'm sure you can't, and I'm sure that John Coverdell is much better qualified than me, having done it in practice. I've only stood on the sidelines and commentated. So no, of course, it's extremely difficult. So it's difficult to know what you do, but we certainly know what you don't do, and that is you don't arrive to speak to the community with the very people who are involved in perpetuating and doing nothing about that violence. We know from that UNAIDS, for example, should be who've just released guidelines on sex work. Who have almost released new guidelines on sex work, where they offer which offer very little or nothing in terms of fighting back against violence and human rights abuses. The only human right that the UN system is interested in is the right not to become a sex worker, and they're recommending that money should be spent on educating girls so they don't become sex workers. That's the human rights discussion that's the environment we're operating in. So while it's very difficult to talk about what should happen in a perfect world, we've got some very strong ideas about what should not happen in this world in order to make this a smoother path, and we'd like those to be listened to more by UNAIDS and by the rest of the UN system, by the research organisations, and perhaps principally by national governments.
I was going to ask a couple of things to the speakers. First, Cheryl, you made the comment that there'd be concern among sex workers about an agent that is only 60 to 70% effective, whereas I think maybe Solon would be very happy to find an agent that was even anywhere near that. So
who would?
I mean, in the vaccine world, I mean that's a sort of a very ambitious target. So there's a
well, he's not a female sex worker.
No,
is he?
But I'm just saying. I just like
unless there's something we don't know.
To hear comments from both of you on that sort of, there's quite a big gulf there. The second area I want to be interested to hear comment on, in the trial setting, it's been interesting that a number of the Garnet-Schnopfer trial and the recent diaphragm trial, a number of the microbicide trials. What's happened is that it seems that condom use actually does go quite high in the sort of in the counselling and support regimens that are in place. That it actually goes to levels that are substantially higher than sort of what you might call the background, as far as I'm aware. And so I guess it's not so much the trial setting where the condom the issue of condom reduction is of concern, but it's more post-trial or outside the trial setting, and how do you sort of start to prepare for all that? So it's two different issues I'd be interested to hear the panel's comments on.
I'll go start first with the 60% effective vaccine or microbicide. A 60%, let's say for 60% effective microbicide will be extremely effective. It will change the whole face of HIV. For example, in Southern Africa, women whose husbands are having sex with other partners and who are highly vulnerable and only have sex with their husband, who are unable to use condoms with that husband, classically she will be, her chances of remaining HIV negative will go up by 60%. If you're a sex worker who manages to use condoms that are 99% effective 60% of the time, in a high seroprevalence environment, it just means that the gun you're putting to your head has got, it's just a matter of calculating the number of bullets in the gun that you're putting to your head as you're playing Russian roulette. And if you're in a medium seroprevalence environment and you stop using condoms and start using something that's a lot less effective, even if it's even allowing for the greater frequency of use, our information and modelling that we've done indicates that the benefits will all be clustered, and not only us, Global Campaign for Microbicides and others all agree, and the UNAIDS Working Group on Prevention and others, so it's not me talking, all agree that the benefits of these of less than 100% effective biotechs will be clustered to women with lower numbers of partners. The second one is your second question is difficult for me to comment on, John, because I don't believe most of the statistics about HIV prevention results in many of these countries anyway. I think that one of the things that happens when there's a trial is that better information comes out about what about behavior. I think that the standard of our behavioral surveillances are so low that it's we're really shooting in the dark to be comparing the two. To me, that's one of the great advantages of trials, is that it does put the microscope on prevention activities in that place.
Other comments on those issues?
I would just say I do feel that an opportunity gets lost in a sense when a trial ends. We have seen in virtually, as John has said, in virtually all the trials that both arms increase for whatever reasons. It may be the attention that they're getting, it may be the personalized counseling, it may be the condom access that wasn't so good before, but they do increase their safer sex behavior. And at the end of a trial, instead of, I mean, it seems to me one of the things we ought to be doing is seeing them as potential peer opinion leaders. And so they get thanked for having participated in the trial, but we don't basically work with them to see how they can then be peer opinion leaders to carry forward into the community the messages about safer sex counseling. And these are opportunities we're missing because we tend to see things as sort of isolated boxes of activities.
You know, one comment on that. I think one of the big challenges we face with doing these kinds of clinical trials is that they tend to be strongly funded, supported, and built up as trials. And it can become very difficult to try to build in the mechanisms that would allow for the kind of continuity that you're talking about. And so I think if there were a way to try to bring together the players who would be necessary to bring together so that you've got this type of clinically based research integrated more strongly into a broader sense of prevention and even treatment access so that we really do get to build on the capacity that comes with a trial in a sustainable way. Prevention researchers are researchers. That's their strength. So it's not going to happen because prevention researchers decide it will happen. We'd all have to go back to school to learn how to become people who can implement programs. So we need partnerships in order to do that sort of thing.
Solid.
I just strongly agree with Kate's comment because, you know, the experience we have with HIV vaccine, that having the national commitment, you know, at the national level and the country level, and having the approved national AIDS vaccine plans have been very useful in discussing these issues, you know, what will happen, you know, after the trial is ended, because the national country does play an active role and has a longer-term perspective rather than the only trial-related perspective, and make sure that there is a continuity and there is no vacuum after the trial has been completed.
Okay, thanks all. I'd like to hand over to my co-chair now to take us through to the second half of the session. Karen?
Thanks. I think we'll move into the second set of speakers. If they'd like to come up, we've got Vasanta Muthuswamy and Christine Grady and Daniel Tarantola.
For the draft of the guidance that Kate mentioned, you know, I will keep it at the back of the table, and then if there are not enough copies left, you just give me your card, and we'll set the share.
Okay, so our first speaker in this session is going to be Dr. Vasanta Muthuswamy, and I'd like to invite you to come up and speak. I think everyone has the bios of the speakers that we printed in advance, so we don't have to spend time introducing. Thank you.
I would first like to thank the organizers for having invited me to give a brief presentation on the standard of care regarding the HIV vaccine trials in the context of Indian context from the country perspective. I would like to, since India is one of the countries which is having the HIV vaccine trial, which is ongoing, it's very important that how did we address this whole issue of in access to care, especially the standard of care in a clinical trial setup. Since the national policies for the treatment is something different, and when you're looking into a vaccine trial and you want to do something which is different from the national policies, it becomes very difficult to come to kind of a national consensus on this issue. When we are looking at the whole issue of standard of care, of course, it is a required or agreed level of quality achievement of provision of welfare and protection to avoid risk, damage, or error as per the Oxford Dictionary. And when we are looking at the nature of the prevention or a cure that will be provided in the participants in the research, and when especially in the context of the HIV vaccine, we are looking into the different groups of people who are eligible for access of care in a particular trial situation. We're looking into the general care and treatment that should be given to all the participants in the trial. The second is there are special care or special reference should be made to those who are in the treatment arm as well as those who are in the placebo arm or the control arm. And third is those group of people who are coming, participating, who want to participate in the trial and who are there in the screening protocol, but after the screening they are found ineligible for a trial, but then they are still has become part of the study. What is the kind of a standard of care which should be provided to them who had the intention to participate but who are not participating in the trial? Of course, this is an issue of international debate, because the debate is that should we have a universal same policies or should we have different policies, which depends on the different countries, or even within the countries, it is different on when a government-sponsored trial, what kind of a policy can be undertaken, and if it's something where government is involved and a totally private issue, what kind of a policy we should be there implemented. Now, as far as the Indian government is concerned, we have the Ethical Guidelines for Biomedical Research, which was first released in 1980 and then revised in 2000, and then very recently it has needed further revision. The way the ethical issues are developing and being debated all over the world, it is now becoming increasingly important for all countries and agencies to revise the ethical guidelines at more frequent interval than what we did earlier. As far as international collaborative programs are concerned, we have said that the provision of the best possible nationally available care should be given to the participants. But then when we have used this particular statement, it's not a very clear statement in the sense that it can be interpreted in different ways. When you have a national program when you say nationally available, many people say that it should be as per the national programs, what the government is offering to the people of the country, which should be followed by everybody. In the case of an HIV-AIDS case, it is different. The HIV treatment, the access to care, the standard treatment, is not provided to the entire population of the country free of charges. It is only recently, very recently, it is introduced in certain states, I'll show you that, where the treatment is available free of charge, provided by the government to a certain category of people. It's not given to everybody. So if you want to have a trial in the country, across the country, at any place, especially in states or the provinces where the access to care is not available, how are you going to differentiate it? It is where the programs where nationally the entire country is getting a particular treatment for a disease, it is easy to follow this particular rule. But HIV-AIDS is different, and here the problems are that if you have this within the country, it is happening in so many countries now, that is the whole problem of the HIV-AIDS. We have the different policies, different kind of a reality happening within the country, and what is the kind of a strategy we'll have. The strategy which we had in phase one HIV vaccine trial, I'll tell you, but when we think of the future, after the phase one is over, when you are going to launch the phase two and expand it to phase three, is it possible for all countries to follow the same kind of a provision which we had given during the phase one trial? The most important is, we heard from the previous speakers, that if any country, if you want to have a successful program for the access to care or for the standard of care, it's very important that the national government should have the commitment. And that commitment is there as far as India is concerned. The government is very well committed to this program, and various policies are being formulated over the years. Not only from the state national level, but also with the local health authorities. There are continuous discussions are going on between the scientific groups and the ethics, various ethics groups. Large number of their non-governmental organizations, advocacy groups are involved in this consultation, where government itself is taking a lead role forming a parliamentary committee of the parliamentarians who are looking into these issues at a very personal level. The large-scale negotiations are also going on with the host community where various trials are done by setting up healthcare infrastructure for use during and after the study. It's also, they also discussed about authorization of distribution of the care after the trials are over and during the trial. What kind of a decision should be made about payments, royalties, subsidies, technology, intellectual property, and the distribution costs? And the discussion involves international organizations, donor agencies, NGOs, and private sector, along with the community representatives. But the issue is that if you look at India as a whole, that we have seen the red states. These are the six states where the, which is the HIV prevalence is highest. And these are the six states in which now the government of India is providing the standard of care free for all. Only for the post-exposure prophylaxis throughout the country, the treatment is available free in all the health centers. But as far as the standard treatment for HIV/AIDS is concerned, only in the six highly predominant states where it is said that more than 1% of the antenatal women are positive, and that's why they have been taken as a high prevalence states. These are the states in Tamil Nadu, Andhra Pradesh, Karnataka, Maharashtra, more from the southern region of India, and one at the northeast India, where it is high prevalent, and the policy which has been taken is that the free treatment will be given for certain groups. Now, as far as the HIV vaccine trial is concerned, the Ministry of Health went to an agreement with the National AIDS Control Organization, which is part of the government, and also with the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative to conduct the trial in India. And this agreement was signed in 2000, and subsequently, 2 years, extensive exercise was initiated to prepare the site, design the study, mobilize the volunteer groups before initiating the trial. Two studies have been initiated, one at the National AIDS Research Institute at Pune in the state of Maharashtra, the second at the Tuberculosis Research Center at Chennai in Tamil Nadu. The phase one has just been completed and the follow-up is on in these two centers. Community engagement has been taken up in a very major way and developing community-centered research agenda with a lot of discussions using the community, setting up the community advisory board and the community involvement plan at these two sites. The principal investigators, the issue was raised that whether those who are not related to the trial should give the counseling, but we have followed that the subjects participate in a trial because of the confidence or faith they have in their treating physicians in a place. So although there are different stages of community consultation, the principal investigators directly interact with community, discuss with them all of the aspects of the HIV/AIDS, including the standard of care, through various mechanisms, and then only finally the participants are selected. A three-tiered community approach is taken up, where the first level, large number of women are screened, where the general lectures are given and they are explained about the whole issue of HIV/AIDS and the implications. And then those who are volunteering are taken up at a second level where more information is given to them. And finally, one-to-one kind of discussion takes place with the volunteers before they agree to take part and the informed consent is taken. Now, as far as these particular trials are concerned, as I said, it has been decided that care will be given for all those who become HIV positives during the trial. If anybody, after the trial has been initiated, becomes HIV positive, they will be given treatment for their lifetime. An independent arbitration committee is set up by the Government of India, which will decide about the compensation related or unrelated conditions of those who have participated in the trial. As far as the trial-related injury is concerned, the sponsors, that's the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, have taken up an insurance coverage for all trial-related injuries, but as far as non-trial-related illnesses of the participants during the trial, the Government of India, through the Indian Council of Medical Research, has taken in insurance coverage. Now, India, for the WHO statement of 3/5, Government of India decided that 1 million people in these six high-prevalent states will receive antiretroviral drugs free of cost from 1st April 2004. But then it's restricted, I said, to certain categories, only to three groups. Mothers who participated in the prevention of parent-to-child transmission program as seropositive antenatal cases, the seropositive children below the age of 15 years, and people with AIDS, full-blown AIDS, who seek treatment in selected government hospitals. Government of India is also in dialogue with the pharma to optimize additional potential reduction in the cost of ARV drugs. But then along with this group is added those who participated in the vaccine trial. If they become positive, they will also be given the free treatment at these six states. But the problem is that, as I said, there are the India government, India has 32 states. Out of which six states are given this provision. Now, those who belong to the other states, when future trials are taking place, phase one is a very small trial with only 30 participants in each of these centers. But this is possible. When the trial is extended to phase two and phase three, where more centers are involved, more number of participants are there, and states where this treatment, of course, government of India is scaling up this treatment, it will be extended to other states in the coming years. But then this task is very difficult, especially in a vaccine trial, this was possible. When we talk of all preventive trials and standard of care and access to care for all preventive trials, when the number is going to be much more, it's not a very easy task. I think we are having a lot of consultations in the government of India along with the different stakeholders to see that what kind of a strategy we should adopt, what kind of a consensus we should give. So the process is still ongoing, and this is not the only answer, but it's we have been able to achieve something in this trial, but I think much more has to be done in the coming years. Thank you.
Next speaker is Christine Grady from the NIH. Thank you.
Thank you. I was asked to speak about the institutional perspective. And so I'm going to talk about the NIH, but I wanted to make clear that although I work for the NIH and I will talk about the NIH, I'm not officially speaking for the NIH. I thought it would be helpful to start, though, to isolate what we're talking about in terms of care and treatment, because I think when I think about what kinds of care people need in the context of clinical trials, including HIV prevention trials, but not limited to, there's so many kinds of care that we can talk about, and they're all important, but sometimes they should be planned for in a different way. So the kinds of care that people need include the care which is part of the scientific design, which is necessary to answer the question, the care that's needed to safely complete a trial, the care for injuries or other adverse events that are caused by the research, the care that's promised to participants, which might not fit into those previous categories necessarily, post-trial care, which people talk about all the time as a separate entity, and then what some have termed ancillary care. And under this is basically everything that doesn't fall into one of those previous categories. And ancillary care can really be thought of as, in itself, two categories. The kind of care that you can predict that people will need, and the kinds of things that come up that you have no way to predict. I would suggest that most people have talked about or have come to think about the care and treatment of people who seroconvert in an HIV vaccine or prevention trial as the kind of predictable ancillary care that people will need. And so the discussion has focused, of course, on what kind of care, what does that include, for how long, by whom, and whose responsibility is it? You all know that years ago, the UNAIDS, the previous UNAIDS document, and we now know that there's a new one, suggested that a comprehensive care package should be agreed upon through a dialogue between the host, the community, and the sponsor. Dr. Hankins just said in the previous panel, now it's a government, sponsor, researcher, and community dialogue with the same idea, a dialogue which reaches some consensus prior to initiation of the trial. And UNAIDS in 2004, and Ruth Macklin cited in her 2007 article, that there's now broad, although not unanimous, agreement that ART and a clinical care package, so that's what treatment we're talking about, should be provided to those who become infected. So that's who we're talking about. Now, those are pretty narrow groups, both of those, and we may wonder if that's all we're talking about. Ruth Macklin, in this paper that she published this year, 2006, said there were three flawed assumptions in the previous debate about whether ART and other care that people who seroconvert in a trial was a responsibility, and that those flawed assumptions included these three: that sponsors should bear the sole burden that governmental agencies should bear the sole burden or that developing countries should bear the sole burden. And the presumption changed because all three of these assumptions were refuted to come to an agreement that all three share some responsibility and they should be negotiating with each other. I thought for a second it would be worthwhile focusing on what is a sponsor. And both in the paper that Dr. Tarantola and others have authored recently in Vaccine and in ICHGCP, there's a precise definition of a sponsor as somebody, an individual, company, institution, or organization that takes the primary responsibility for the trial. And that's different a little bit from institution. So I'm coming back to what I was asked to do, was talk about the institutional perspective. Any public or private agency or medical facility where clinical trials are conducted, or an organization, et cetera, devoted to a particular cause, which I think is an interesting way to think about it. Now I get to the NIH. So the NIH is an institution and a research sponsor, both. And it's the primary U.S. government agency for conducting and supporting medical research. There are lots of institutes and a huge budget, about $28 billion, annually. And the cause or the reason for the NIH is to encourage and support research. And this is by U.S. law. The authority of the NIH is to do research. The NIH does this encouragement and support of research primarily through funding competitive grants and contracts. So there are more than 50,000 competitive grants and contracts to researchers around the world with NIH money. It's also true that NIH is the largest funder of HIV vaccine research in the world. And I think it's of interest to note, although I don't have this on the slide, that most HIV-related researchers think that the funding for HIV vaccine research has been inadequate, and not just for vaccine research, but for all prevention research. The HIV vaccine budget in 2005, and I put that date because I wanted to compare it to this other document that I found, was $511 million. And in that same year, according to the HIV Resource Tracking Group, which is a consortium of YAVI, AVAC, UNAIDS, and the Microbicide Network, the total global investment of private, public, and philanthropic organizations for HIV vaccine research was $750 million. So you can see the HIV vaccine budget from the NIH is about two-thirds of the total global investment. And it's been going up every year. So what does that tell us about providing care in vaccine trials? Well, the NIH, although they support most vaccine research in the world, they don't have a specific policy about whether people should be given care in the context of an HIV vaccine trial. The commitment is there, but there's no specific written policy. So I thought it would be useful to look at a different policy than NIH does have on the provision of antiretroviral treatment for people who are in antiretroviral trials when the trial is over. And it's interesting that the guidance, which came out in 2005, supports a commitment to making sure that people get treated after a trial is over, but also reiterates that the NIH does not have the authority to pay for that treatment. So what the NIH does instead is it expects the people that it gives the money to, the investigators and the contractors, to address the provision of antiretroviral treatment after the end of a trial, and recommends that they work with host country authorities and other stakeholders to identify available sources of treatment. And NIH also says that in this context, they may give priority to sites where sources have been identified for the provision of antiretroviral treatment at the end of a trial. So in HIV vaccine research trials, the same kind of thing probably adheres in the sense that NIH may give priority to sites where treatment is available through a country's national plan, through PEPFAR, or through the Global Fund, so that this issue of treating people who seroconvert in the context of a trial can be dealt with. NIH also requires that the informed consent clearly articulate what the plan is. NIH also supports the HVTN, HIV Vaccine Trials Network, which you probably are all familiar with. It's an international collaboration devoted to testing preventive vaccines against HIV, and it's funded by the NIH, by the NIAID, in fact. And HVTN, several years ago, published a commitment to making sure that participants who became infected during HVTN vaccine trials would receive long-term antiretroviral treatment. But because HVTN was funded by the NIH and could not use, therefore, NIH funds to pay for that treatment, HVTN created a fund based on contributions by private donors and solicitations from commercial vaccine developers. And the fund exists to pay for treatment of people who seroconvert in HVTN trials. And they work with the local PIs and the community advisory boards to develop the specifics of the treatment plan. Also thought it was important to mention that the Office of AIDS Research every year goes through a very elaborate, deliberative process of developing plans and strategies for their research, the HIV-related research for the coming year. So in the recently published fiscal year 2008 Trans-NIH plan, they say that their highest priorities for fiscal year 2008 are prevention research, including microbicides and vaccines. And in a document which includes a number of different foci, if you will, for the research, the prevention research, there are references to this issue of treatment. And this one in particular on page 59 of the document says, and I'm just going to read the second half of it, that researchers should establish networks within the community that will effectively and on a continuing basis address the social and medical concerns of participants, which to me addresses this issue of treatment of people in trials. So I'm concluding really by coming back to what UNAIDS, I think, wisely said several years ago, and what I've heard people say ever since, including the previous panel, that people who are in HIV vaccine and other prevention trials need to have the kinds of care and treatment that they need, and that the best way to make sure that that happens is that there should be some negotiation prior to any trial between the governments, the sponsors, the researchers, and the community to determine what predictably people will need and to make plans for making sure that that will happen. I think, having said that, I'm very aware, and some of the previous speakers noted it, that how formalized that agreement needs to be, how detailed that agreement needs to be, I mean, Kate McQueen spoke to this very eloquently, I think is something that we are all still working on, and I think Dr. Tarantola actually is going to talk about right now, but negotiation is the answer. Thank you.
Dr. Tarantola.
Thank you, Karen. You should be giving this talk. You know more about the subject than I do. I'm not a bioethicist. I'm a public health practitioner, and the role that I played in the two-year process of developing the guidelines which are included in the article was merely a role of facilitator between disciplines and across specialties that had differences of views and opinions about what is a very critical issue relating to people's lives in the context of vaccine trials. The document that is behind the behind you there that you can pick up on your way out, the article published in the journal Vaccine, summarizes the outcome of this iterative consultative process. Because time is short, and I think we are running out of time, if we want to save enough time for question and answers and your interventions, and because previous speakers have already covered a number of points that I intended to cover, do not be shocked if I skip some slides or go very quickly through them. This, I think, will not affect your understanding of the logic and underlying the presentation I'm going to make. I will focus on the process of decision-making, not on the outcome. I will not suggest for a minute that we should set universal standards of care applicable to clinical trials. What this paper suggests and what the process concluded is that we should have global guidance on how to arrive at a consensual decision in with transparency and, as importantly, documentation in specific contexts where vaccine trials are being considered or are about to be undertaken. The article that is at the back of the door of the room here is titled Ethical Considerations Related to the Provision of Care and Treatment in Vaccine Trials. It is the outcome of a series of consultations that, as you see here, took place in a variety of settings, and the point was that we wondered whether the problematic that we were supposed to address or asked to address would vary from one cultural context to the next, but also from one context with a particular access to health system, healthcare, versus another. And so there was a series of discussions that involved public health practitioners, medical practitioners, clinical trialists, community members, and so forth. And every single consultation brought a piece to the work that resulted from the process. Now, why these consultations? Why a focus on vaccine trials? Well, the first reason is that there are more and more trials taking place in developing countries. And this is a great thing. However, health systems are very often constrained by lack of resources or structures in these countries. And so it is hard to set a standard of care that would meet the universally achievable standard of care in every single setting. There is also a reason why this consultation took place. The principle of justice as equality and reciprocity and the principle of beneficence call for access to care by research participants for conditions targeted by vaccine candidates, but there is no indication either in the Helsinki documents or else in the COMS guidelines or else in the UNAIDS 2000 guidelines as to how those standards should be set. Who should have access to them, for how long, who should bear the responsibility of financing the scheme. And so the task that we were charged with was to define precisely a process that would help arrive at such a decision. Focus on care should not be exclusive. Similarly to care, prevention needs also standards in clinical trials. But the standards of prevention are very commonly set in the protocol itself, while the standards of care are very commonly left open until either there is a need to respond to demands for care or else there is a crisis, as was seen in the tenofovir trial. The access to care influences minimally the outcome of vaccine trials. And so often it is not defined. And it is either insufficiently or just not at all described in the protocols that those clinical trials rely on. We define here the standards of care as, and this is a working definition which is very close to what Vasanti showed us earlier, as the specifications of eligibility criteria, including the type, the level, and the duration of care, treatment, and support. Now, the series of consultations raised a number of points, and time, unfortunately, will not allow us to go through them. But beyond the standards of care, a number of issues were discussed, not all of which were resolved. Some summary of that exists or is presented in the document at the back of the room. The central questions were, and this is reminiscent of what Christine just showed us, are the following questions. Who should benefit from care? What type of care should be considered? What level of care? And who should bear the cost of care? These were the central questions that were asked. Now, we felt that there was there definitely room for a matrix, and public health people love matrix, so we had one. And that one tends to match the who with the what. Who are the people who need and should be provided with care on the one hand, and for what diseases and condition? Now, you could enter that matrix from either way, but we determined, we felt that entering the matrix from the sort of human way was probably the best. We were concerned about people first. And so the care for whom, here are some populations concerned with care in the context of vaccine trials. First, you have trial participants who acquire the disease targeted by the vaccine. They acquire HIV in the context of an HIV vaccine trial. You have trial participants who have severe conditions detected during the trial that are not specifically targeted by the vaccine being tested. And as health practitioners, I believe we have some responsibility to provide medical care to people who are being witnessed as being affected by a severe disease. We just cannot be blind and walk away saying that our work is merely to do clinical trials. Individuals considered for enrollment but excluded as a result of pre-enrollment screening for diseases relevant to the trial design. So they have been screened out of the trial, but they have been diagnosed with HIV. Now, the knowledge of HIV demands that there be some approach to care provided. Who bears that responsibility? To what extent? For how long? And so forth. Other persons linked to trial participants but not considered for enrollment in the trial, for example, sexual partners, children, who with around the trial participant himself or herself will require some form of treatment for illnesses that may be identical to the illness diagnosed in the trial participant herself. And finally, other members of the community hosting the trial. And the second entry point is from the disease perspective. So you can recognize diseases specifically targeted by the vaccine being studied, but then you can also see diseases that are diagnosed as part of the design in order to determine the level of protection conferred by a vaccine. For example, you may run a cholera vaccine trial and run and include an HIV test in order to find out whether the immune response is identical in HIV versus non-HIV infected individuals. But then the diagnosis of HIV in this case also requires that treatment for HIV in the context of the cholera vaccine trials be considered and built into the protocol. And then finally, unrelated to the purpose of the trial, but detected incidentally in a population under surveillance. These are typically the so-called adverse events that are being monitored and responded to. Now, defining the standards of care for specific populations and diseases, building on the simplistic matrix I've shown before, leads us one step forward. And you can see that now there are different categories of populations here, if I may call them categories, and different types of diseases that may have to be considered. Now, within each of these cells, standards have to be set. What is it that we are going to offer to, for example, take any cell in this table to this population for this particular disease? And if you enter one of those cells, these are the questions on the right-hand side that start arising. What care and treatment will be offered through existing services? What additional care and treatment should be provided? For how long? Who will deliver care and treatment? Who will provide the resources? There was an agreement in the group that led to this document that not a single donor or source of funds will ever be able to foot the bill of care needed in the context of the vaccine trial. But it should be a combination of efforts as long as there is an open negotiation around this issue and very clearly delineated responsibilities among the stakeholders. Who are those stakeholders? They are listed here. As you see, they go far beyond the usual relatively small team of people who conduct clinical trials. These include volunteers, participants in vaccine trials, communities and so forth, health systems, NGOs, care organizations, regulatory authorities, and naturally the local health system, because very often the care would have to be provided through existing health systems, and this may be a guarantee of long-term sustainability of what is put in place. We developed the concept of good research governance, falling short of recognizing that a single entity should be responsible for the process described here, and that the ethical research committees were not always, at least, but very often not, the appropriate locus of decisions around the issues presented here, that there was something different that was needed, which was a participatory governance mechanism. I will skip that for the sake of time and just remind ourselves that good research governance could be or should be setting standards, defining mechanisms to set standards, more importantly, describing, monitoring, and assessment mechanisms, and basically, overall, improving research quality and safeguards by the steps that are listed here. We then moved on and said if a consultative process, broad-based, was to be put in place, transparent, with a very strong element of accountability, documentation, and a redress mechanism, a complaint and redress mechanism, what sort of information should we look at that would help the group to arrive at some mutually agreeable decision? We started to list a number of questions, basically, or pieces of information that would be useful, and we eventually categorized them into those four categories. One was normative type of information. It's basically established international, national, local norms and standards. That information has to be gathered. The document that's at the back of the room suggests who could gather this information, what sources could be considered for this type of information. Secondly, factual. That's basically the background evidence relevant to decision-making, specific to the local situation where decisions is being made. Thirdly, evaluative, where you have to perhaps do a scenario building or do an exercise where you apply your imagination and express your fears as to what could happen and then work out how you would respond to those unforeseen events that could happen as the clinical trial unfolds. And then prospective, which is basically projecting the resources, allocating responsibilities, and defining who will bear the cost, the responsibility, ensure accountability as the project moves on. So in summary, I will not go into the detail of this long matrix. That matrix is not prescriptive. It is largely descriptive. It offers a menu you can pick from in your own setting. It is intended to illustrate the kind of questions that you, that members of the communities, participants in trials, should be informed about and should be able to understand in ways in the language that is familiar to them. In summary, the guidance that is being provided is relevant to the global level, but we prefer to provide global guidance rather than global standards. We concluded that broad participatory, transparent, and documented process was preferable to a black box, and there are a number of trials that are built around those black boxes. We concluded that we should develop user-friendly guidance materials. There is hardly any community that could digest this document that's at the back of the room here. It needs to be adapted, translated in words and concepts that people can relate to, whether they are sex workers in Cambodia or drug users in Latin America. Consider the expansion of this approach to other prevention trials and learn from the practical application of the proposed approach from rhetoric to practice, and there are a number of clinical trials where this approach has already been applied, not always in a structured fashion, but at least has been sort of put through the test of fire, and what came out of that is rather encouraging. And finally, there is a need for capacity building, not only of the ethical research committees, the national regulatory authorities, which are very often totally ignored in the process, and they are the ones who should see to it that clinical trials are properly conducted and that the post-trial period is also taken care of, and health systems, researchers, and communities. So there is a long task or a huge task ahead of us, but I think if we can do that, we will ensure both that research quality improves and that people's interests are protected. Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 15 minutes, and which seems a ridiculously scant amount of time given the issues that were raised here, but I'd like to open the floor for questions. Can you state your name for the third time? And
Hi, I'm Peter Newman from University of Toronto. Particularly in terms of Dr. Tarantola, thanks for a very comprehensive view, and I understand that this can be a useful heuristic in terms of processing through any of those boxes and listing a whole array of potential stakeholders. I wondered if there's some aspect of this, and maybe it's outside of this document,
that addresses the fact that, of course, there's vastly skewed differentials in terms of power and resources among the different players, so that obviously governments and national bodies would have a whole lot more power and ability to even articulate their concerns than perhaps local community stakeholders in some contexts. And I wondered how, or if part of the process is how do we address that, or how do we make sure that the stakeholders are actually, I mean, stakeholders that do represent the community and that the voices are kind of heard in a more level playing field.
Thank you. I think you're right. The tensions that are likely to arise are tensions that will result from the imbalance in power. And I think that information is the first step. The capacity building within communities and those who legitimately speak on their behalf, and I say legitimately, not the self-appointed speakers on behalf of the community, these individuals and groups have to be engaged in a capacity building process. The transparency that is proposed here is also, I believe, an element that will sort of balance out the imbalance of power, if you will, because it is certainly easier to abuse your power when you do it in the black box than when you do it openly and when the communities are involved in the process. And so transparency, accountability, capacity building, basically, not easy, but necessary. Thanks.
I think the comment is often made about capacity building also, that it's a two-way street, and we're always talking about building the capacity of communities to understand trials, but I think is also equally crucial to build capacity of researchers and sponsors and governments to understand communities. And that's, you might say that those who are in power don't accept necessarily their need to have their capacity built, but I think that's an equally a crucial part of the equation.
I wondered also in terms of this process, and maybe I think you did mention it, but just so I understand better. So there are these guidelines, and let's say they're even set out before a trial. What happens if it's seen over the course of the trial that some major stakeholder, and usually one in more power, is not really following the spirit of the guidelines? Is there any authority designated in any aspect of this to say, you know, to have some accountability that's not just closing down a trial, unfortunately, because people perceive it as unfair, but to say, no, you have to do this. I mean, you said you're providing treatment for people with this type of condition, but in fact, these people are all being turned away effectively, or there's not really a place for them to go.
Yeah, certainly there is a need for careful monitoring of what is happening as the trial goes on. Whether you want to appoint external monitors or whether in addition you want to generate community awareness of how they themselves can monitor what they are getting and what they are not, that is an important part of the preparation for the project itself. Then there is a needed structure there for claims and for redress. We propose that in the matrix. There should be a process for people to lodge their claims, for them to be verified, and for a process of redress to take place. We did not go to the extent of describing the judicial procedures that should be in place. We felt that this was so different from one country to the next, but that can be a consideration as well. So I think it is important to be vigilant about deviations from commitments. Again, documentation is important, transparency is important, and a monitoring mechanism should be in place for that. I know this is all theory more than practice. It's very hard to translate into an effective monitoring mechanism, but the essence of this is that it should be a monitored and accountability central.
Am I allowed to ask a question?
As long as you respond to it.
Well, you guys have to respond. coming from a country, I work in Thailand, where there's a trial going on now that we feel is has many unethical aspects, or aspects that, as we're talking about the need to change things, are going on now. For example, it's a tenofovir pre-exposure prophylaxis trial among injecting drug users, where they're using a placebo but not providing clean injecting equipment. I know that just last week I saw drug users at one of the drop-in centers holding the tenofovir pills in their pocket. They're not even taking them. And, of course, this has, like, implications for the quality of the data, and it's a long litany of reasons why the communications broke down. In terms of accountability and transparency and community investment and all of that, I'm just wondering, especially from the NIH, given its enormous amount of money and influence, and particularly in Thailand, U.S. government relationships with Thai researchers is so important and influential. I was wondering what kind of things are put in place to ensure that community can be strengthened, to ensure that local IRBs can have the capacity and the time and the money to do their jobs properly, and what kind of investments are going to be built in for countries to be able to use these kinds of standards that you're promoting in a better way than they are now? Are there, you talked a little bit, I'm interested in the accountability piece, since we're talking about communities that are so powerless. You know, if we can work on, if you guys can work on from in your areas the kind of accountability that you could build into working with developing countries, and we as community can, of course, work on working with our communities to raise awareness and build capacity. But there has to be some sort of tangible investment, I think, in this, and repercussions for people who are not following the procedures. Because in Thailand, we didn't shut down the trial. We tried to get a win-win situation, but that didn't work out, and sort of everybody's back in their own corner, not very happy, and the trial I don't think is going on particularly well, and I think it's a loss in the end for everyone rather than a win-win with an improved standard of care in a country. A lot of benefits could come out of better dialogue and real partnerships that are supported by a little more than they are now.
I think you raise a very interesting problem of how do we make all the things that everybody's talked about on this panel work in the sense of community, government, researcher, sponsor, negotiations, and agreements. I mean, I think you can make certain agreements, and then how to make sure that that everybody adheres to them is a very difficult problem, and some of the questioners have raised that as well. I think from the perspective of the NIH, and again, I'm an official in my response, but the way the NIH works is it can set expectations for researchers and the people who receive the grants in terms of what they need to do to conduct their research. And so expectations, for example, community involvement is an expectation of most HIV research, and you can't get a grant unless you show how you're going to do that and how you're going to engage the community in the process of developing the study and conducting the study. There are also, as you know, monitoring. You're monitored every so often, and there are mechanisms to shut down trials, but you don't want that to happen necessarily. So, I mean, there are some mechanisms in place for accountability and for setting the expectations ahead of time, but they're not perfect, and it really does need constant communication between the various parties involved. And sometimes, I don't know the particulars of what you just described, but sometimes it's not going to come out the way you want it to. That's my view.
Just like to add to this, yes, the most important component is the community component. We may have a training or capacity building for the researchers and also for the regulatory authorities and the government policymakers. But I think the most important component has been the community advisory board members who are selected from the community, and they are given intense training, at least in India. And we have also made them attend a large number of workshops of this nature in different places sponsored by us so that they do understand really what is it meant and what are their rights and what is expected. And that's been, and this arbitration committee, which has been set up, in fact, for the very first time in the history of the clinical trials in India, that we have an arbitration committee which is totally independent of the trial sites or the investigators. And anybody, any community member, if they feel that the guidelines are not being followed and something is going wrong, which should not have happened, they have the right to go to this, appeal to this arbitration committee to look into these issues, and which has never happened earlier. I think this HIV vaccine trial, of course, for the vaccine trial, which has been set up, but then this is a precedence for any other future kind of trials where community's interest is to be protected. But then this is a learning experience for all countries. I think even within the country, as I said, that what we have done in this trial is very difficult to duplicate it in so many other trials at the different places. But I think that a lot of thinking is going on in this and seeing how do we protect the community members. I think this interest is there. People are genuinely concerned, whether it is the government authorities or the researchers are genuinely concerned about it, and that's a large number of NGOs are being worked with this. But I think the whole world has to go a long way to really achieve what you think is the ideal and the best way the community is to be protected. I think all of us have to keep on discussing, because the way the guidelines are now getting revised everywhere and new guidelines are coming up, it shows that the issues are increasing. They are not reducing in number. But I think efforts are being taken by all the countries. So that's an experience which we have seen. Of course, in India, the government is very committed. And both the trials which have gone on, as well as the other microbicidal trials which are going on, are all directly under the Indian Council of Medical Research, which is a counterpart of NIH in India. So, we are part of the government. And so there is a monitoring mechanism. Otherwise, the most important and difficult component is the implementation of guidelines and the monitoring, which is generally not done anywhere. And that is a thing which is just now we are learning, that the monitoring has to be done. And that's why I think all these forum for ethics committees which have come up, where I am secretary of the Asia Pacific, we have 6 other fora in the world, we are trying to tell the ethics committee, IRB members, that please take up monitoring as your additional role, not just evaluation, so that they take up some of the responsibilities of the sponsors or the government to see that they do local monitoring, to see that trials going on in their site is being done to the best possible way.
My name is Michael Burke, University of New South Wales. I just have an interest in the situation where you have marked gender imbalance in power in communities, where in fact, say if the women are subjects, what recognition is given to the reality of the implications for the partner, where in fact if say the woman is diagnosed positive and where in the context there's a significant belief in concordance, whether or not the partner's issues are addressed, and how is that partner prepared, given that in a sense there's a risk of a proxy diagnosis being made to the person participating in the trial.
I think that was quite well addressed by one aspect. I think it was Kate Hankins in the guidelines emphasised that there was an increasing focus on the implications of trial participation for partners and families and people beyond those individuals. I think that was part of Kate's points, wasn't it? So I think that issue is certainly on the agenda very much. Obviously, it's going to vary from context to context.
I just wanted to make a quick comment. I was thinking about a vaccine trial that took place, which is now closed, in Brazil, in Rio. We've focused a lot today on trials involving women, and certainly I think perhaps because of the tenofovir experience, which I and others spoke about, we're focusing on places where there's high-risk women, low literacy, and so on. I watched a cohort come together, a longitudinal cohort that was kept together for many years in a vaccine trial in Rio, and it was extremely successful. There was a record low dropout rate. What's that called? There's a name for that. Sorry?
Retention.
Yes, a high follow-up rate, and I'm showing my ignorance here about the technical terms, which is my job, isn't it? And the key to that success was that it was MSM involved, and that all the counsellors and the recruiters were from the community. So I agree with John, absolutely, and that was the point of really of my talk, that researchers and communities need capacity building, but researchers and communities don't necessarily need to be mutually exclusive groups. Communities can actually be actors within research and can be trained to do some of that recruitment, counselling, retention, and various, the various problems that have been raised here. And I haven't actually, apart from the fact that I dipped out for a while, haven't heard people talk much about communities being involved as researchers and mixing that lot up. And of course, researchers are always very welcome to come and sell sex, especially if they're as good looking as John.
Stop it, Cheryl. I wasn't aware there was another session starting. I thought this was a room that was vacant afterwards. I can see a group of people forming to sort of take over the stage by force if we don't start to shut this down. So I think it is time to close. I'd like to return Cheryl's compliment there by saying it was worth me coming to this session just for the privilege of hearing Cheryl say that I was a ethical and well-intentioned researcher, and I'll treasure that. And apart from that, I think it's been a fantastic session. I really want to thank Daniel and all the others who put it together. And I think what we really see here on this panel and what we want to take forward is that conversation, is that communication. Karen is the person from the community side, myself from the academic side, have people from the government side, and the whole breadth of engagement is represented on this panel, I think is the only way that this conversation can actually have a real impact and start to change the way things are in trials. So I, from my point of view, wish that to go forward in the same spirit. I hand over to Karen for the final word.
Word. Thank you all for coming. That's it. I think people are trying to get in the room, but I also feel like it's an honor to be here with all these incredible people, and that I hope that we all work together to push for better ethical trials and communities and getting the prevention tools and treatment, access to treatment that they need. Thank you.